The speakers today, there are three of them, are going to address the question, have the churches retreated from seeking peace on earth? And peace on earth, goodwill to all, is some of the words that are going to be read in the churches this Christmas. And the question we want to put today, are the churches in our country interested in peace on earth? And are there more than isolated examples of commitment to that purpose? The three speakers we have today have been have already chosen in what order they're going to speak. They have about 10 minutes each, which I know is not very long, but they've accepted that. And then that will be followed by lunch and the program, and the lunch today, as usual, are $8. Michael Cabrera, who is the first of the speakers, is a professor of philosophy at the university, and with a special interest in religion and ethics. The second speaker is Reverend Kevin Powell, of the pastor of the Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd, who in Ontario was part of the Ontario Interfaith Coalition. And finally, our third speaker today is Marie Moyer, a Mennonite peace activist, a graduate of the University of Lethbridge and the Canadian Mennonite College in Winnipeg. We welcome these three people. We look forward to what they have to say. And Michael, we'll start with you, please.
Thank you. The problem is not that religion hasn't done enough to promote peace. Rather, on the contrary, religion is the major part of the problem and always has been for the history of humanity. If you look at read the Old Testament, you see that that Old Testament Judaism was constantly at war with the various fertility cults that prevailed in the day, collectively known as Baalism. Today, of course, Islam is at war with Christianity, with Hinduism, with Judaism, and of course, it's also the case that even within the family of Christianity, Protestantism is at war with Catholicism. So it's obvious that a major source of confrontation in the world is religion itself. The Russian composer Scriabin said the best religion would be no words, just music. But given the history that I just outlined, people would fight about who had the best melody. I'm not able to give you much more than a series of definitions. It's important to distinguish a religion from a theology. A theology is an ideology about supernatural beings, the gods. They are supernatural persons. An ideology itself is a system of ideas that contains a view about reality, the real world, the view about an ideal world, and a strategy to get from the real world to a better world or more ideal world. Of course, in the context of religion, the strategy is usually prayer. I just see on the bulletin board on the way in this morning that on the tower that one of the claims that if you pray, you will be given hope. But of course, throughout the history of religion, you've been promised more than that. That's what a theology is. And a religion, on the other hand, to be distinguished from a theology, is an organization for marketing an ideology. It's engaged in ideological marketing. Religion is to a theology what a political party is to a political platform. The main goals of marketing are obviously, one, to increase market share, secondly, to establish brand loyalty, and third, to control the market, and to do so, you have to control government. Of course, religion sells its ideology by offering a major rewards program. The rewards are that if you look at the history of religions, number one, you will be rich. If not rich, you'll at least be happy. If not on earth, then you'll be happy in the afterlife. If you're not going to be happy, then perhaps you'll settle for feeling morally superior, holier than thou. By simply being a member of a particular organization that has a system of beliefs. And if you're not even going to be feel superior, well, then religion will offer you, as I said, hope. And if you don't even have hope, Well, then, misery loves company. On the other hand, brand loyalty, of course, is marketed or established by not a rewards program, but a penalty program. I mean, if you don't believe, you're told that you'll be subjected to political subjugation, or you'll be subject to pestilence, suffering. You'll be turned into a leper. You'll be turned into a pillar of salt. You will be crucified, perhaps, and die. Or if, you know, failing all that, you will go to hell. Of course, they control the market by trying to establish a theocracy. Theocracy, of course, is supposed to be a rule by God. But, of course, we know that's a euphemism for rule by religious leaders. And you can, it comes about in two ways. One, you might have a state religion, or secondly, you might have a religious state. Let me end with this little comment in this season. One of the main teachings of Jesus was that Hosea was right. God doesn't want ritualistic sacrifices. What he wants people is to care about each other. And he also was a follower of the prophet Amos. The Jews are not God's chosen people. The very idea of having a chosen people, a people chosen by God, is itself guilty of injustice and bad discrimination in the worst sense. And what Jesus, of course, taught is that people shouldn't discriminate on the basis of irrelevant factors. And, of course, if you're not going to do that, then you're not going to be a champion of any religion. I think the moral of the story of Jesus, rather, is that that in an ideal theology, there would be worship of an ideal being in the sense of a glorification of an ethic, but there would be no religion. Thank you very much.
I'd like to invite Kevin Powell now to come and speak to us. Kevin?
Well, after that, doing what I do and dressed like I'm dressed, I wasn't sure if I should come up here. My goodness. On November 26th, Christian Peacemaker team members Norman Kerber, Harmeet Sood, and Jim Loney, and Tom Fox were taken hostage by a group calling themselves the Swords of Righteousness Brigade. On November 29th, right-wing radio show host Rush Limbaugh, commenting on the hostage taking, said this, and I quote, "Part of me likes this, and here's why I like this. I like any time a bunch of leftist feel-good hand-wringers are shown reality. Any time a bunch of people walk around with a head in the sand, practicing a bunch of irresponsible, idiotic theory, confront reality. Then I'm kind of happy about it, because I'm eager for people to see reality and change their minds if necessary, and have things sized up." That comes from the good folks at MediaMatters.org. I'm guessing the irresponsible, idiotic theory he was talking about comes from the favorite philosopher of a certain U.S. president, a little-known wandering sage named Jesus of Nazareth, who also said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You've heard that it was said you should love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." I could go on and on, but I think you get the idea. And given the full-throated support folks like Limbaugh have given the Iraq War, not to mention their defense of the U.S. as so-called Christian country, together with some of their high-profile Canadian clones, the question of have Christians abandoned peace on earth is, on many fronts, a very appropriate one. However, not since apartheid in South Africa has there been such an overwhelming worldwide consensus among religious leaders regarding the important issue of the war in Iraq. From the Pope to the Archbishop of Canterbury to the Eastern Patriarchs, the African Pentecostal preachers. the message to George Bush and Tony Blair was clear. The invasion of Iraq did not meet the criteria of the just war. And at the local level, the message remained the same. In the run-up to the Iraq invasion, my congregation in Halifax, the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection, held prayer services every Saturday at noon. We kicked them off with an ecumenical gathering, which included leaders from a variety of denominations and faith communities. And we raised a united voice in prayer, pleading for peace, unified in opposition, for a greater vision for the world than one provided for us by many world leaders. And from there, we joined thousands of others opposed to the war, and we marched through downtown Halifax in the cold January wind. And among us were two Anglican bishops, as did most of the pastors in the city. And my congregation was well represented. But one member stands out in my mind. Arnaud Brzak was 90 years old, a refugee from World War II Europe, post-World War II Europe. She had seen war up close and very personal, having lost many family members to that war. Although she harbored a special hatred for tyranny, and Saddam certainly fit that category, she hated the human cost of war even more. She marched on that January day because she knew that Jesus' message of self-giving love for neighbor and even for our enemies was more powerful than any weapon of mass destruction. And she wasn't alone in the congregation. I found it really interesting that those in my congregation who were most opposed to the war were war veterans and European immigrants, folks who still bore the scars of war. It's easy to sit back and criticize churches for not doing enough. I play that game as well. But as a parish pastor, I believe passionately in the power of ordinary Christians doing God's work underneath the radar screen. And while Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, and Rush Limbaugh may be among the loudest voices in Christendom, we need to remember that they do not speak for Christianity. Theirs is a partisan political agenda that confuses the gospel of Jesus Christ with the gospel of worldly power. But to ask whether churches have withdrawn from contemporary social and systemic issues by focusing on more individual matters is, in my opinion, a false choice. When we say that we need to confront sinful structures that keep people in poverty, we need to ask ourselves what that really means. When we confront government, by what authority do we speak? And what authority, why should the government listen to us? What authority do we have? Do we then become a left-wing version of the religious right by demanding that government adopt our agenda? What is the relationship between church and state? But the underlying question is, how is society and how is the world transformed? I have helped organize grassroots anti-poverty organizations and rallies. I have helped organize days of action to protest draconian cuts in our social safety nets. I have spent many hours in the cold rain and blowing snow with a placard in my hand, and I have written countless letters to and visited with government leaders and private enterprises advocating a more just treatment of our world's poorest citizens. And after years of banging my head against the wall, I began wondering if changing social structures begins with changing people's hearts. Because like poverty, social structures are not abstract, impersonal notions, but they are the product of people. So I wonder if to change structures, we need to change people. But I also wonder if we let ourselves off too easily by saying we need to confront sinful social structures than to engage living, breathing human beings. And that's where churches come in. That's where churches excel. Most Christians are deeply concerned with issues of war, with issues of racism, the environment, poverty. And we really do believe that we are called to witness to a different reality in the world than the one that is given to us. And there is hard work being done by individual Christians walking together down the hard road of faith. When I flip through my own congregational directory, I see a diverse group of men, women, and children, people from all ends of the political spectrum, people who, despite many almost irreconcilable differences, have followed the Spirit's leading and lived together in the bond of Christian love. I'm thinking of two church members, one a liberal and one a conservative, that sit down for coffee to talk about the most divisive issue facing our church, the blessing of same-sex unions. They share openly and honestly. They argue. They pray. And then they shake hands and agree that no matter what the outcome, whatever the church decides on this issue, they will still be brothers in Christ, because baptism trumps politics. Or I'm thinking of the crotchety old man who's been a thorn in the flesh of one congregation for over 50 years, particularly of one man who's been a pillar of the church for almost as long. These two men sat on opposite sides of the table yelling at each other, while the other quietly asserts his view. They agree on nothing for over 5 decades. But when the old guy starts to fail, and he can't get out of the house, he's shut in. He can't even get out to get groceries. This other fellow, who's been tormenting for 50 years, makes the trip for him twice a week. No big deal, he says. The guy's got to eat. Or I'm thinking of the teenage mom who stumbles unexpectedly into church one day, holding a newborn baby. She hasn't been to church since she was a little girl, and she has very little money and very few clothes for the baby. Some of the women of the church conspire and throw this woman a baby shower. Nothing big or extravagant, just something to get her started. The women do this because she is loved, no matter where she comes from. I could go on and on because the churches are filled with stories like this. This is what the churches are doing. Is this social justice? Probably not. Is it life-giving? Definitely. This is what peace on earth looks like in the churches. Where have we abandoned peace on earth in the world? Definitely not. And we could be doing more. Because peace on earth is not a political agenda, but a deeply human one. I think the fact that churches are trying to figure out what peace on earth looks like is a sign that God hasn't given up on us yet. And that's why Christians celebrate Jesus' birth at this time, the poor child born in a barn, who brought life and salvation to a hurting and a broken world. But the Christian task is not done yet. Together we struggle to live Jesus' message of the kingdom of justice and peace and new life. Sometimes we get it right. Sometimes we mess up completely. But that's because at the end of the day and at the beginning of the day, we are human, struggling what it means to live out what our salvation looks like. Thank you.
Marie Boyer.
I would like to approach this question from three angles today. First, through a brief look at Mennonite history. Second, since the way that Terry initially posed the question to me, in that way he used participation in peace demonstrations as a sort of barometer of church commitment to peace, so I'm going to talk a bit about Mennonites and public activism. And finally, I will give some examples of what pursuing peace on earth looks like from our own perspective, not using the standards of secular society to measure it. As a Mennonite, I've been brought up in a church culture that is defined by our peace stance. I never really made a conscious decision to become a pacifist. It's something into which I've been socialized from birth. The heroes of my childhood stories were not knights, ninja turtles, or Xena princess warriors, but rather ordinary people elevated to almost mythical status by their choosing of martyrdom over retaliation against their enemies. Dirk Willems is one of the most famous. His story is told in a collection of early Christian and Mennonite martyr stories called The Martyr's Mirror, first published in Holland in 1660. In the turbulent days of the Reformation, subscribing to the wrong belief system was grounds for extreme persecution. Mennonites, being a rather small and subversive group who believed that peasants could interpret the Bible and that it was unchristian to serve in the military, were definitely considered by many states and state churches to be in the wrong. And so our Mennonite hero, Dirk Willems, is heroic for one simple act. One day in the winter of 1569, he was fleeing on foot across a frozen body of water when his pursuer fell through and was about to drown. Dirk turned back, rescued him, and was subsequently captured, arrested, and burned at the stake. Love for one's enemies was not a biblical command taken lightly by my forebears, even when it ensured their own demise. Mennonite peace theology has always insisted that nonviolence is to be practiced not because it is more practical or more effective or better for everyone involved than is violence, but simply because Jesus said, "Love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, turn the other cheek." It is a matter of faithfulness, nothing more, nothing less. The interesting thing about persecution is that it often serves better to solidify the particular identity of a community rather than to destroy it. Mennonites tried to protect themselves from decimation by fleeing the states where they were living and becoming increasingly insular in their new host state, living in segregated agricultural communities, having little to do with public affairs, and counting assimilation as apostasy. In this context, the question posed here today, and particularly with the context that Terry gave it to me originally, is not an easy one to answer from a Mennonite perspective. Can a communal commitment to nonviolence be equated with seeking peace on earth? Perhaps not. Simply refusing to participate in violence is not quite the same as actively trying to right injustices in the larger society, nor is it even bringing the good news that Jesus preached into a suffering world. At times, if I look back critically on the history of my own church and my own people, I have to conclude that sometimes it has been a cop-out. Yet the powerful witness of a people who have willingly died rather than killed is impossible to discount. Mennonites throughout the centuries, and those groups who today still prefer to separate themselves visibly from society, like the Amish, the Hutterites, and Old Colony Mennonites, hope that their actions will speak louder to their neighbors than words ever could. All of which brings us to modern Mennonites in present-day Canada. While it may be true that other denominations were more involved in peace activism in the 60s than they are now, it is, as far as I can tell, having a somewhat hazy memory of the 60s, certainly not true of Mennonites. In the 1960s, although Mennonites like my parents and grandparents were assimilating more and more to Canadian culture, Mennonite churches were still very much withdrawn from political and public affairs. So although peace was a very Mennonite thing to be involved with, peace activism was not. Sometime between that time and the time when I became conscious of what was happening around me, a number of Mennonite churches and conferences have emerged from this isolation and connected with or aligned themselves with some of the broader movements within the Christian church as a whole. I propose that this connecting and aligning has taken two distinct paths. The first is an alignment with what we could term the evangelical movement. This particular path sees salvation as a solely individual state, not a corporate or systemic one. Other characteristics include a primary focus on increasing church membership and an increasing concern with end-time theology. When I talk with members of these groups who are concerned about peace in and of itself, I often find a very high level of frustration. It seems to them that their own church has, without even being consciously aware of it, lost the passion and dedication to peace for which their ancestors sacrificed so much. A second path out of isolation and into communion with broader movements is the path of social justice, through which many Mennonites have begun to develop a political conscience. And I would point to the activities of the Mennonite Central Committee as the primary outlet through which many Mennonites put this kind of theology into action. The Mennonite constituency which supports and funds MCC is incredibly broad, including very conservative groups, very liberal groups, and to a lesser extent, evangelical groups. Because of this, MCC necessarily shies away from anything that is seen to be too political. What unites all of these diverse Mennonites is action, not activism. I'm continually amazed in my work with MCC when I sit around a table with a small group of leaders who include people who were card-carrying members of the Reform Party when it existed, as well as people who would happily vote for a communist candidate if they were given the opportunity, and everything in between. While such political affiliations do exist among Mennonites, many of us are still reluctant to publicly align ourselves with political parties, in part because of the tension that it would create within organizations like MCC, and in part because getting involved in politics is just not a Mennonite thing to do. In preparation for this talk, I asked a number of Mennonite church members and MCC workers about participation in peace rallies. There was a fairly broad consensus that A, they felt uneasy about the partisan politics present at demonstrations, B, the marches were too militant, and C, in the most recent rallies, there was too much anger and perhaps even hatred aimed towards the Americans. These are serious charges that I think the peace movement ought to consider. Besides the Mennonite aversion to political stances, the main point here is that peace demonstrations have not been peaceful enough. Personally, I got involved in the planning of some of these demonstrations precisely because I feel that Mennonite churches have a really valid point here, and I hope to bring some of that influence to the table as we considered how we would organize rallies in Lethbridge. I also pointed out to my fellow church members that if enough Mennonites showed up, it would effectively shift the character of the rally to whatever we deemed appropriate. But alas, Mennonites aren't really the type to even attempt a peaceful takeover of a peace march. So my challenge wasn't taken up. I personally found this rather frustrating, and in some ways, my whole presentation today is a small summary of my wrestling with this question. Why are we Mennonites the way we are? So passionate and dedicated to peace, yet so reluctant to proclaim it to the world. If there's a criticism that I would aim at my own church, it is that we have been plenty willing to put our theology into action, but we haven't been prophetic enough. So finally, let me tell you about some of the ways that Mennonites do actively seek peace and justice on earth. First, through prayer. In the secular world, prayer is often justified as a last resort, but for Christians, it is a first resort. German theologian Karl Barth wrote that, "To clasp the hands in prayer is the beginning of an uprising against the disorder of the world." So I've got this little prayer card here from the Mennonite World Conference. It came in the mail last month. And I'd like to highlight just a couple of requests. The churches in Asia are requesting that we pray that the churches of Asia can demonstrate peace. From Africa, pray for freedom from corruption and that peace could prevail. From Latin America, pray for peace with justice in Colombia. And from North America, pray for an honest appraisal of the impact of the invasion of Iraq and a change of heart. Second, I would like to hold up one example from MCC. Every year at Christmas, MCC promotes Living Gift Project. One of the projects sponsored this year is in Rwanda, and it's called Women in Dialogue. Here it describes it as a group that helps ease hunger and promotes healing by bringing together people from different sides of the Rwandan conflict, and they do this by farming together. So at 10,000 Villages, which is a project of MCC, this year, you could buy, for about $30, a goat as a gift on behalf of someone on your Christmas wish list to support this project in Rwanda. So one of my friends, when we were talking about this, told me that Mennonites are practical people and we're just not convinced that demonstrations actually accomplish anything. Why go to a peace march when you could buy a goat for peace? As a final example, I would like to mention the Christian Peacemaker team. To me, they are a modern embodiment of the most daring and courageous aspects of Mennonite peace tradition, willing to get in the way of violence, as their motto suggests, even at great personal risk. And they are willing to take on issues that are fraught with politics and require extremely fine maneuvering in order to maintain a nonviolent approach. CPT is a project of the Mennonite, Quaker, and Brethren in Christ churches. They currently have projects in Iraq, Hebron, Colombia, Ontario, and along the U.S.-Mexico border. CPT was begun as a response to a challenge made by Ron Sider at the Mennonite World Conference Assembly in France in 1984. And so I'd like to just conclude with a selection from, or a small quote from some of his words in that speech in 1984. He says, "Over the past 450 years of martyrdom, immigration, and missionary proclamation, the God of Shalom has been preparing us Anabaptists for a late 20th century rendezvous with history. The next 20 years will be the most dangerous and perhaps the most vicious and violent in human history. If we are ready to embrace the cross, God's reconciling people will profoundly impact the course of world history. This could be our finest hour. Never has the world needed our message more. Never has it been more open. Now is the time to risk everything for our belief that Jesus is the way to peace. If we still believe it, now is the time to live what we have spoken. We must take up our cross and follow Jesus to Golgotha. We must be prepared to die by the thousands. Those who believed in peace through the sword have not hesitated to die. Proudly, courageously, they gave their lives, and again and again they sacrificed bright futures to the tragic illusion that one more righteous crusade would bring peace in their time, and they laid down their lives in the millions. Unless we are ready to start to die by the thousands in dramatic, vigorous new exploits for peace and justice, we should sadly confess that we never really meant what we said, and we dare never whisper another word about pacifism to our sisters and brothers in those desperate lands filled with injustice. Unless we are ready to die developing new nonviolent attempts to reduce conflict, we should confess that we never really meant that the cross was an alternative to the sword. Thanks.
Let's perhaps ask Kevin and Michael and Marie to come up here, and invite you to come here with your questions, since we only have one mic, and let's have at them and have at the issues of peace. Peacefully. So, I invite the first questioner. If you'd give your name and be brief.
My name is Ted Mitri, and my question is to Michael. Thank you for your challenging comment about religions. When I was in seminary, I don't remember the person who said this. I wasn't a good student in seminary. Was it Arnold Toynbee who said, basic problem of the world today is monotheistic religions. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they all claim that their God is the only God, therefore they fight each other all the time. Could you comment on this?